Live from Chicago, this is Beyond the Beltway. Sitting in for Bruce Dumont, my name is Chris Roebling, and I welcome all of you to tonight's program and our fantastic panel of guests, Democratic consultant Kitty Kirth, Democratic activist Amicia Cross, Scott Stantis, the political cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune, and from the University of Chicago, former chairman of the Political Science Department, Charles Lipson. Good evening, everybody, and thank you for joining us from coast to coast, border to border, whether you are listening to us on WLS 890 AM here in Chicago or on any of the other terrestrial radio stations or on the internet through beyondthebeltway.com or even on XM Sirius POTUS Radio. We welcome you to tonight's discussion, and we're going to get underway right away with a question for Kitty Kirth. You know, President Obama went to the great state of Illinois this week. He went to Knox College in Galesburg, and he had a speech about the economy. And so my question for you, since that was probably the biggest political news of the week, was how much traction will Barack Obama get with Congress on his points in the speech this week about the economy?
With Congress, you said. That was the operative clause.
I did say with Congress because theoretically they have to work with each other.
Well, you know, I think that it takes two groups to work together. The president has repeatedly reached out to Congress on health care, on the economy, and repeatedly been rebuffed. However, I saw a little bit different stance in his speech this week, and I think he is going to try to get everything he can get done without Congress, like he did on climate change and on some of the recent environmental moves. I think he's going to try to pass everything he can without Congress and keep trying to work with Congress. But, you know, it's been their stance since the inaugural, the first one, that their biggest goal is to not work with him. And I haven't seen any change from the congressional side.
Scott Stantis, how much traction for President Obama from this week's speech with Congress?
I'm not sure how much. We didn't hear anything new this week. It's sort of the same old, the statist, you know, social democratic construct of government going forward. And those darn Republicans, it always stuns me when Democrats are stunned that Republicans play in Washington, D.C., the game of politics. Of course they're going to oppose his policies, and they oppose his policies because there's a principled reason to oppose his policies. This is really reasonable stuff. And the Democrats have done this to Republican presidents before.
Yes, but. Yes, but.
We'll pick that up in a second. Amicia Cross, workforce participation in the U.S. economy has dropped in the last 4 years, from 65.7% to 63.5%. Will President Obama's speech lead to a turnaround of that trend?
Honestly, I would hope that it would, but if I'm honest with myself and the American public, as well as his level
Please
of honesty,
be.
The answer would probably be no.
How come?
I believe that the way that the economy is structured right now, when you're looking at recent grads who are not able to find full-time work, you're looking at people who have been laid off recently and still aren't able to find work. We have some people who aren't even being counted in the unemployment numbers who've been unemployed for 2 or 3 years plus. It's going to be really hard for you to make a statement in a speech that's going to make Americans rally behind you when they know what it's like on the ground.
Charles Lipson, is the meaning of Amicia's statement the fact that the policies of this administration have not been working?
Well, I thought that the big news was that you suggested that President Obama's speech ended. I wasn't sure. I thought it might still be going. It was a speech all about redistribution and blame. This has not been since the failure of the stimulus program. They don't have a growth program. They simply don't know what to do. And there's been a loss of about $5,000 per family for median family income. My sense is that we have reached the high water mark of liberal policies in Washington. There are simply no new ideas and no ideas that are working.
Now, it's because they haven't pursued an actual Democratic agenda. Obama hasn't spent enough money investing on infrastructure. The health care program hasn't come in. Speaking as, I believe, the only small business person at the table, my biggest own your business. I own my business.
Okay.
My biggest obstacle to hiring more employees is not having access to affordable health care.
Right.
As soon as October comes around and I can start buying affordable health care, I can hire more employees. Right now, it's just too much money.
Can I ask you a question? Do you
Absolutely.
Think Democrats will run on Obama's health program?
Absolutely. I think in the states where it's been implemented, the health care costs have gone down, both for people newly entering the health insurance market and for current employers and current job producers. I think for all of us who want to employ people, our costs are going to go down. We're going to be able to hire more workers. All those companies who've made so much money in the stock market and have record profits, if they would start hiring again, Things will change. They're the ones that have to start hiring again.
But there's additionally,
just one second, Amisha, sorry. Additionally, investing in infrastructure. It's proven that it works. We have infrastructure that needs to be rebuilt.
But I want to say,
we need to do it. Those are the Democratic policies that Obama has not embraced strongly enough.
Amisha, do you agree with Kitty, your fellow Democrat on tonight's panel, that the president has been insufficiently Democratic?
I probably wouldn't say insufficiently Democratic. I will say in certain ways he has been pushed further to the middle than he probably would have liked. And at any point when he tries to go a little bit more leftist or when he tries to pursue things that seemingly would increase the level of social programs and create a safety net even for those who are currently working, it is a problem because of the construct of Congress right now and the fact that Congress has pretty much balked against everything that he has tried to do. But in addition to that, I don't think that a speech pretty much giving out the American dream in so many words, is actually going to be something that gets America going.
Also, the ideas, I mean, quotes from the speech, I mean, it's an okay speech. It's not one of his best. And some of those language is perplexing, like we're going to grow from the middle out, which is like...
Leading from behind?
Yeah, it doesn't make a heck of a lot
after
of sense.
After the upcoming break, I want to talk about phony scandals and that quote.
Okay.
But let's get more into this speech. I think everybody here agrees that there wasn't anything substantially new in this speech. There was not a set of new initiatives or new programs. If that's the case, then is the president really beating his head against a wall, sort of like the Republicans in Congress who keep passing repeals of Obamacare? If he's proposing in the Galesburg Knox College speech things that have already been turned down, isn't he just like the House Republicans who are all voting for things that are not going to get past the Senate, Charles?
Well, I think that that both are playing to their bases, and I think that both are trying to rally support behind those positions. But if good speeches got this economy going, I'm agreeing with Amisha, if good speeches got this economy going, we'd have a Reagan recovery.
I think what could get the economy growing is things like, what Paul Tsongas did a million years ago, investing in public-private partnerships, taking money, putting it into Chrysler, getting the government paid back quickly, and making money for the government and creating jobs. That's the kind of things we need to do in Detroit.
That's Kitty Kurth. She's joined tonight by Charles Lipson, Amisha Cross, and Scott Stantis. I'm Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont. Our phone number, 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289. Your questions coming up on Beyond the Beltway. From coast to coast and border to border, Sunday evening it's Beyond the Beltway with Bruce Dumont, except this Sunday evening, my name's Chris Roebling. I'm sitting in for Bruce, taking a well-deserved Sunday evening off. Our phone number, 1-800-723-8289. We're coming to you from the home of the Museum of Broadcast Communications right here on State Street, that great street in Chicago. So our email address for email questions, BTB, Beyond the Beltway, BTB@museum.tv or 800-723-8289. We look forward to hearing from you as our conversation continues with Charles Lipson, Scott Stantis, Amisha Cross, and Kitty Kurth. Now, let's talk about another element. We were getting into politics about the president's speech at Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois, earlier this week. A oft-repeated quote from the speech was, quote, "With this endless parade of distractions and political posturing and phony scandals, Washington has taken its eye off the ball." And the president went on to say, you know, that's the ball is jobs and recovery and growth and prosperity. So let me go to you, Scott Stantis. Whose fault is it, if the president is right, that the eye has been taken off of the ball? Is he right? And if so, whose fault is it?
Well, whose fault is it? My gosh, there's fault to go around. They're politicians. It's what they do. But seriously, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party have two very, very, very different views of how to fix this economy. And that's a legitimate source of discussion. The part I take great exception to is phony scandals. That's the new mantra from the left about the IRS scandal, which is getting worse and worse and gets higher and higher as the hearings go on and on. So whose fault is it? I think that if you want a Democratic kind of economic solution, then you can blame the Republicans. The Republicans feel very differently.
Amisha, which scandals are phony?
That's a question I would like to ask the president. When I heard the statement, I questioned what he was talking about. I mean, could we say that the Snowden scandal is phony? Could we say that anything that's going on with other politicians who are falling out right now is phony? Could we say that the bickering that's going on between the Republicans and Democrats is actually phony? I think that when you phrase something in that way, it's to take attention off of something that really matters. I think that both sides have played a very strong role in removing themselves in large part when it comes to actually doing something progressive for the economy. And trying to avoid that conversation specifically over the past few months when we saw something very interesting in terms of the stock market doing rather well while Main Street was still doing extremely poorly.
Charles, why would the president use this phraseology of the phony scandal?
It must have been focus group tested, but I cannot believe that that's a sensible line myself. I've heard people say that they think it'll take. But the reason is, I think, exactly what both Scott and Amisha, coming from very different political views, have said. My sense is that they've kicked the ball as far. They've tried playing hide the ball on both Benghazi and the IRS. And I'll tell you something about the Snowden and the NSA, which is bipartisan, by the way. I don't think that that's a party thing. I think that that really hurts the government with young people. I've talked to a lot of young people. They feel that they're on the internet all the time, and they now feel the government's watching over their shoulder. I think that this IRS thing, what happened this past week, which moved it into the office of a political appointee in the IRS, is a big deal. And I think the fact that you now have a woman whose child was killed at Benghazi on TV saying, "My child's death is not phony," can't be a good thing for the White House.
Kitty Kurth, what's the White House rationale for the phrase, you know, distracted by phony scandals and political posturing?
Well, I think the whole IRS thing is something that if you've ever applied for a 501c3 or a 501c4 thing, it's always been a political process. There's always been a lot of questions that you get if you're trying to. When I founded the Concord Coalition with George Romney and Pete Peterson and Warren Rudman and Paul Tsongas, you know, we were an educational organization, a 501c3, but we were talking about political issues. So back in 92, we got huge amounts of questions about
how long did it take y'all to get?
About 9 months, but we had a really, really good high-powered lawyer in D.C.
But they're talking normally about four and five times
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that's normally that's what it takes
let me ask now. Let's we've got a list of 215 groups that were detained in this Kafka-esque cesspool down.
Looking at a lot of them, I would have never given him 501c3.
I'm not asking you that question.
I would have given him 501c4.
Well, I'm not asking you that question. You know,
that's what the scandal is about.
205 of the 215 were conservative. Doesn't that raise
Actually, I think you've got your facts wrong, Chris. Since then, they've come out
notion
that
absolutely
many
not right.
that many more were actually on the left as well. But quite honestly, if I were looking at any,
if I were looking
at any group with party in the title, I would say on face value, That's not either a 501c3 or a 501c4.
Okay.
Let me finish. Yeah. That is a party. If they want to be a party, they have to file by the political rules, and they have to file with the FEC, which is a different process. It's not a tax-exempt group. If you call it party, it's not a tax-exempt group.
All right.
It's neither 501c3 nor 501c4, period. End of story.
That's not end of story, and quite the contrary. The fact of the matter is, well, I'm not sure where you're getting your facts, because if you look
at law says
if
you are a political, the law says if you are, let me finish, because you talked about party. The law says that political party is a political party.
No, but the testimony before the Congress has said expressly, was she told to send liberal and progressive groups for special scrutiny? No. She did not scrutinize the applications of liberal and progressive groups. I would send them to general inventory. Now, I understand it's a long process, but this went into an abyss that if you were Patriot or if you were Tea Party, that's
party,
what,
party, that's
and
it.
One
that's
group
what sends you
their
into the
name
abyss.
To green and got it immediately.
I want to point out something that Peggy Noonan reported from the Ways and Means Committee in the United States House in Washington. That notwithstanding all the talk about production and about cooperation, that as of last week, House investigators said that they had, in fact, received less than 1% of the public documents they had sought from the Internal Revenue Service. Amisha, is the Internal Revenue Service coming clean with the American people?
At this point, and this is hard for me to say being a Democrat, but I honestly don't believe so. I think that all the evidence suggests that there has been a certain level of favoritism played. And it's really sad and it's really shameful on part of the administration that sort of thing would be allowed, and that you have this erroneous number that seemingly continues to grow. I've heard different numbers quoted from different sources, but all of them are in the 200 range of organizations that have gotten away with this.
I think that Demetria is right. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Finish up.
It's sad because there is no way that you can claim that you did not know or that they were not subject to the same level of scrutiny as the other ones happened to be. Some seemingly just got passed through while others did not. And it's hard to believe that that's not a conscious effort.
Let's take a quick call from Anne Marie, who is listening to Beyond the Beltway on WLS, the Great 89 here in Chicago. Anne Marie, your view.
That Obama would present all these scandals as phony. I mean, you have somebody like Kitty or Katie, whoever her name is, backing that up. As if, well, she goes along with lying just like Obama does every time he opens his mouth.
Yep.
So he's lying that he didn't give the order for the tax exempt groups, and he's lying about Benghazi. I mean, nobody seems to know where he was. He's conveniently absent during Benghazi.
All right, so Anne Marie.
Still lying about Fast and Furious. Of course, he gave Eric Holder the order.
All right.
So, I mean, just lying his ass off.
I'm not sure that we can say that on family radio.
Sorry.
But Anne Marie, thank you very much for phoning
in. Oh, we just got a picture from Anthony Weiner of that. I'm sorry. Oh, no.
Not talking about. There are certain subjects that are not being brought up tonight. All right, Kitty, Anne Marie is obviously very possessed of her view. But here's my question, a neutral question now. Do you think that the administration has been fully forthcoming about these issues?
I don't think they have, but I think that people who believe that President Obama has enough time in his day to go over every order that's been given to the IRS don't have a really realistic view of his schedule. And I think further, getting back to the party issue, if you were to send in a 501c3, not a tax-exempt form to Lisa Madigan here in the state of Illinois, if it had party in the title, it would automatically be rejected and sent over to the State
what
Board
if
of
it
Elections.
Has constitution,
right, Chris? Is that,
or...
No, as long as it has party in the title, I think you were on the Board of Elections,
yes,
right?
I was on the Board of Elections, so I can't speak for Lisa Madigan's office, but I want to ask, do you, Scott, and we've heard on the sufficiency of production question from Amisha and from Kitty. Scott, has the administration played straight with the American people on this issue?
Of course not. I mean, this is just like Benghazi when Jay Carney came out, and I happened to be in the briefing room when he kept saying this was, you know, the attacks were because of the YouTube video, which, of course, was horse feathers. The appointment of Lois Lerner, who was a train wreck over at the Elections Commission, and then he puts over at IRS, this was, in my view, it'll probably come out very clearly that this was a politically motivated actions by the IRS and politicizing the IRS, just like justice
the American public,
politicized as well.
The American public is deeply concerned if it's bureaucratic incompetence or if it's political, but if it's political, it's even more serious. It was an article of impeachment against Nixon.
All right, that is Charles Lipson. You've been hearing from him and from Scott Stantis of the Chicago Tribune, Democrat activist Amesha Cross, and longtime Democratic consultant Kitty Kurth. The program is Beyond the Beltway, normally with Bruce Dumont. I'm Chris Roebling sitting in. We'll be back after a few minutes. Stay with us. It's
somebody else.
Beyond the Beltway with Bruce Dumont, except tonight it's Chris Roebling, and joining me here in the studio, Kitty Kurth, Amesha Cross, Scott Stantis, and Charles Lipson. This came up very briefly in our last conversation, so I want to get back to it. We referred to the Snowden scandal, but the Snowden scandal, a sort of a related question about the NSA eavesdropping, okay, or the NSA data gathering, if not eavesdropping, came up this week in the United States House of Representatives, and a very interesting political event took place that no one found it in their interest to discuss this weekend on the TV talk shows, and that is this. The current regime of NSA surveillance actually won a vote in the United States House of Representatives, and Kitty, the majority of that support for the president's program came from Republicans. And Democrats did not support their president. So what the heck is going on in that crazy Democratic Party? There's a fight on the left, and I want you to explicate.
For that one, thanks, Chris. You know, on all of this NSA stuff, I find it very... I just assumed that everybody's been reading my emails and listening to my phones forever. You know, I remember back when Newt Gingrich's phone calls got recorded when he was on
down
a cell
in
phone.
Florida.
Georgia. Florida, whatever. I just always assume that anything on my computer or on my cell phone is being looked at. I think
so
it's
you're
awful.
Not you're not concerned.
I'm completely concerned about it, but I don't think
Democrat,
we can do anything about
it. Okay, but the Democrats in Congress were voting against the president. And the Republicans in Congress were voting for the administration's position.
But now, both parties are split, Chris.
That's true.
Wouldn't you say?
But
the
145 votes
on this issue,
came from the
Republicans. Honestly, Charles, I think, you know, you were talking about this issue with young people. I think there's a generational divide. I think if you were to put five Democrats at a table, there'd be five different opinions about it. Five Republicans at a table, there'd be five different opinions about it.
There is a big split, I would say, within both parties. There is a wing in the Democratic Party, and I would put people like Dianne Feinstein in it, retired Congresswoman Jane Harman, people like that, who are very concerned about national security affairs. There are a lot of ACLU Democrats. Within the Republican Party, it's the Rand Paul wing, which are the libertarians.
Cato Institute Republicans.
And then there are a lot of traditional security Republicans. And so I think you see both. I think what's happened here is that there are really two scandals going on. One was a set of leaks. Everybody, I think, almost everybody agrees that what Snowden did was wrong. But I think that the program that was revealed, the underlying program that was revealed, is deeply troubling to a lot of people. And I should say one more thing about the FISA courts. All of these things are approved by the FISA courts. But the FISA courts were really set up to deal with something that looked like a search warrant. They are now making policy decisions that are the sort of thing that ought to go up to appeals court and even the Supreme Court about what constitutes an invasion of our privacy and a violation of the Fourth Amendment.
Yeah.
Amisha, as the certified youngest member of this evening's panel, we turn now to you.
Speak loud. Speak loud, Amisha.
Millions,
speak loud.
Millions of young,
young people.
Go ahead.
This is great. At 25, I can say that I can see from my generation, millennials, something very different when it comes to NSA surveillance. We were not adults during the Cold War era. So I've read about it historically. I know people who actually went through that process. I know some people who even testified in
hearings. We fought hard for you.
But
we fought hard.
Currently, you have young people who have really embraced social media, young people who have really embraced all kinds of electronic media. And to us, to have a level of understanding that somebody can be surveying, somebody can be spying on us, even though you don't have any type of criminal history, even though you're not someone who has come to this country and has committed any acts or seemingly have any type of communication with someone someplace else who's committed those acts, it is seen as a level of aggression towards us and something that takes away a significant right that we have. And it makes us heightened alert about who we talk to, who we share information with, as well as our own faith in government, because the government seemingly has none in us.
So, Scott, is this an issue to get traction for some elements of the Republican Party with young voters?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, but the question, I want to backtrack just a second and say that not everyone at this table thinks what Snowden did was wrong. I happen to believe in transparency of government. I think anytime it goes into the dark, it does bad, evil things. And the FISA courts are a great example. You can it's a secret court. You don't have, and no one has access to it. The prosecutor shows up. No one is there to advocate for the defendant, and they have secret decisions. I mean, that's a
what
that's
the
a
heck is wrong with that?
That's
no,
a
I'm
prescription. That's a
I
prescription
that.
For abuse.
Right,
so,
right.
In terms of watching everything you do, I'm not okay with this. I truly am not. And so, as a libertarian conservative, I take great umbrage at what's going on right now.
So you would have been voting with the majority of the Democrats and the minority of the Republicans against the Democrats' program had you been in Congress this week?
Yes,
he would have been voting with Obama.
No. You would have been voting against
with
Obama.
The Democrats.
Right.
But guys like me would have been voting for Obama.
I was going to say, but in addition to that, I'd also argue, that you, in today's world, we face threats that we have not faced in the past. And we face an enemy that we're not used to looking at. So to a certain point, there does have to be a level of surveillance. Now, when it comes to data mining everyone, is that what we need to be doing? I'm not exactly sure. I particularly don't feel that that's a safe thing to do.
Charles, I think Charles made a really good point, too, about the FISA courts. They've kind of, it's kind of above their pay grade, and they're being asked to make decisions that they were never that they're empowered to make, but they weren't envisioned to be making. And I think also Scott is right, because the level of surveillance for people who've done nothing, it's crazy.
We got to get on. That is just one of these big, you know, icebergs breaking in Congress. But this whole thing, the president's speech and a lot of chatter this week about the Obamacare implementation has been getting people's attention towards the coming legislative season. And you know, there obviously the president was setting up one side of the argument for this coming legislative season. Are we looking? I happen to be with Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin yesterday at an event just across the state line up in Wisconsin, and he looked me straight in the eye and he said, I think Republicans, and this is one of the most conservative Republicans in the United States, quote, I think Republicans who are talking about shutting down the government over implementation of Obamacare have a death wish.
Now, this is true.
All right, Charles, why is that true?
I'm a specialist in international politics, and so I see often situations where there's a rising country dealing with another country, and the rising country often makes its move too soon. And I think if the Republicans, who are essentially on the rise in dealing with Obamacare, they will have overplayed their hand. They will have moved too soon. If they shut down the government, we learned in 1994, you cannot run the government if you control one house of Congress and 41 senators.
All right. Kitty, do you agree with Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin?
I do. I agree with Ron Johnson for a couple reasons. First of all the people who've been able to embrace pieces of Obamacare already, parents with children under 26 still living at home who've been able to have their kids covered, people like me with pre-existing conditions who are going to be able to buy health care. I think all of a sudden, as soon and California and New York, people are really, really liking what they've been able to do. The actual voters are going to like it, and if the Republican Party is running away from it, they're going to lose voters on this issue just like on the other issues of immigration.
It's got some folks on the Republican side say, let Obamacare fall of its own weight. Is that a better way to go?
I don't think so. I think the way it's structured and the way it's being laid out now, that's going to come after 2014. All of this discussion we're having right now, virtually everything we've talked about up to this point is about 2014. Let's be really clear about this.
About the results of the congressional and the sort of the Obama administration desire to one last chance to get the House so they can do all of their policy programs.
Precisely. So the repercussions of Obamacare I think they're serious, and I think we're having that discussion now, which is great. Shutting down the government is political suicide.
I agree.
It is insanity.
We all agree, don't we?
Do we?
With an election that will be a year after, when you have a new president coming in 2015, be it whichever side that happens to be on, you don't want to go in as the party that basically took that away from the American people.
All right. So where then is the break point in the conversation between, say, the debt limit extension and the sequestration? Where will these two sides that seem almost never to talk to each other, just talk at each other through different spokespeople on TV, where will they actually get to a legislative act?
I think that this could be a very big conflict because I think the Republicans are really committed to cutting more and adding some flexibility so they can add more funding to defense. I think that you've already heard the president say it's a non-starter. Jack Lew said it. Carney has said it. So the Democrat, I think that on the issue of the debt limit what the Republicans in the House are going to want in order to get the debt limit raised, that's a big deal. I should say one more thing about Obamacare, and that is the fact that the president unilaterally is not implementing part of a passed law and will not say, Carney will not say, no one will say, if there is any legal opinion that they relied on to simply say, I won't implement a large part of this law. They can't even tell us if this is legally a competent move.
Yeah, all right. So, Amisha, what do you think about the president choosing those sections of the law that he'll enforce?
I believe he felt like those were the ones that were probably the strongest and the easiest for him to enforce. Right now, one of the things that the president is doing is trying to shore up his legacy. He could, in all honesty, as most presidents do in their second term, become a lame duck. He does not have that opportunity.
I agree with you there, but you have to faithfully, he pledged, took an oath to faithfully implement the
But the pieces that he isn't implementing are at the request of business.
Okay.
It's business. It's pushing.
All right, and it does matter that you stick with your station. Beyond the Beltway continues in a few short minutes after these words. Coast to coast, border to border, Sunday evening, Beyond the Beltway with Bruce Dumont. My name's Chris Roebling, sitting in for Bruce this week, and joined by Democratic consultant Kitty Kurth, activist Amisha Cross, Chicago Tribune political cartoonist Scott Stantis, and University of Chicago political science professor Charles Lipson. Let's take a quick call. We've got a couple of calls out here. Let's see. Dave from Gurnee, Illinois, is listening on WLS. Dave, your call, please. Your bottom line point, please.
My bottom line point is every time there's a point made about growing the economy, there's an accent on education. Education is not the answer because all education does is it feeds the monster of the public sector. What we need to grow is the private sector. And anytime Obama talks, or any politician, especially Democrat politician, they always make the point, and it always goes unchallenged. It is not growing education or government that we need. We need the private sector to grow.
Dave, thanks very much for that call. Okay. Dave actually brings up this great divide, which I think Scott referred to earlier. Is there an intransigence in our national policymaking between the Congress and the president that is simply based on this binary issue of are we going to grow government or are we going to empower the private sector? I mean, is that really at the does that have explanative power for the logjam in Washington? Kitty.
I want to get back to something more basic. Private sector needs an educated workforce just as more, if not more, than the public sector. I really...
To be sure. I
education
don't
is why we're lagging.
Well,
here's education is why, and research and development are why we're lagging with respect to other economies.
Right.
I don't understand the premise of that question.
Charles, the dichotomy between government and private.
I think you're right.
Professor Charles.
The mudslinging begins. I disagree with the caller in the sense that I think that good educational outcomes are absolutely critical to the economy. So I agree with Kitty. I do think that there are different approaches that the parties have to how you can improve education and how much of it should go through an expanding public sector versus more competitive charter schools, which may or may not be part of the public school sector. I do think that there is a basic cleavage between the parties on how much they want to emphasize government expenditures versus tax cuts. I think it was a very fundamental choice that President Obama made at the very beginning. Not that we needed to do something to stimulate the economy, but that he would do it through a big government stimulus package. John Kennedy did it through a tax cut, recommended actually by Keynesians. It was much more effective.
All right, let's go to Bill in Austin, Texas, listening on KLBJ. Bill, your bottom line point, please, for the panel.
Obama became president, he killed the auto industry when him, Harry, and Nancy wrote the bill to try to save it for Detroit even before he became president. And then when he screwed up the bankruptcy, he drove all the auto jobs overseas, and now Detroit's done for. He can't create a job. All he's ever done is kill jobs even before he became president.
All right, Bill, thanks very much for that call. I thought Bill was going to talk about scandals. Just to round out that portion of the conversation tonight, Bob, listening to us on KBOI in Meridian, Idaho. Bob, your point for the panel.
Hey, where's the outrage by the liberals and the so-called progressives?
All right, outrage from the liberals.
About
the scandals. What element of the scandal should outrage the liberals? Bob.
Maybe the IRS targeting American citizens for their political beliefs.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Bob, for that. Are you two, as civil libertarian liberals and democratic activists, are you outraged that the IRS may have been targeting American citizens for their political beliefs?
I think the activists should have applied for their status under the correct status.
So it's their fault?
I think everybody, yes.
Amisha?
Partially, I agree. I think that the activists should have. But I also think that that should have been made clear. I've actually never seen one of those documents. I mean, I've never applied, but I think that that should be made clear on them. If you happen to be of a particular party, or your interest or whatever your organization is doing is geared more towards a particular party or that party stance, then yes, there should be clear delineated directions as to where you should go next.
And it's all pretty well spelled out, both on the FEC website and the IRS website.
All right, so all those people are dumb. But let's go ahead,
I think,
Scott.
Also the politicizing of not just the IRS, but also the politicizing, particularly of the Justice Department, the FBI going after the AP reporters' information.
With false statements to get the warrant.
Precisely. I mean, that should also, as a civil libertarian, this should outrage you. This stuff, I mean, executive branch abuses. I mean, let's be clear. Nixon, Republican. Bush, I mean, unwarranted or warrantless wiretaps, which I cartoon and commented against vehemently. We have to, but the point here that's really important to make is executive power, when you hand them power, it almost always gets abused. And that's what's happening here. And that's where the outrage should be, Bob.
Well, I think
any branch going after the press, I mean, I think the thing that keeps us differentiated from other democracies is our freedom of the press. And whether it's the Congress going after it, or the judiciary, or the White House going after the freedom of the press, I got a problem with that from any branch.
And that is Kitty Kurth, who, along with Amisha Cross, Scott Stantis, and Charles Lipson, have been commenting on domestic politics in this hour one of Beyond the Beltway tonight, with Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont. Hour two, we're going to shift. We're going to go overseas and talk about Obama administration foreign policy, take a look at Egypt and Syria and what's going on overseas. We hope you will be joining us at that time. It's Sunday evening and Beyond the Beltway. Thanks for listening. We'll see you in a few minutes. Live from Chicago, this is Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our distinguished panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, professors, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast and border to border. Tonight, featuring commentary by Charles Lipson of the University of Chicago, Amicia Cross, a Democratic activist here in Chicago, Scott Stantis, the political cartoonist of the Chicago Tribune, and Kitty Kurth, longtime Democratic political consultant. Our program is coming to you from our home base on State Street, that great street at the new Museum of Broadcast Communications in beautiful downtown Chicago. Our toll-free phones are now open at 1-800-723-8289. That is 1-800-723-8289. Our email address is btb@museum.tv, and our website is www.beyondthebeltway.com. Ladies and gentlemen, in the first hour, we talked a lot about domestic politics. We might get back to some later on in this hour, but I thought it was important for us to really, first of all, observe the amazing sacrifices made by American servicemen and women, and especially men in those days, whether they were flyers or seamen or Marines or Army members. They were out in Korea for several long years. It's 60 years ago that war was suspended through an armistice. It wasn't really finished. I wonder if we could reflect on their contribution and how they should be remembered in a society that, frankly, is always preoccupied with the now and the tomorrow. Scott Stantis.
Well, I thought what the president comment on that yesterday was absolutely perfect. We owe them so much more than we've been giving them than just to ignore them for fighting the forgotten war. It shouldn't be forgotten. These guys actually did win. If you look at South Korea today versus North Korea, they won, and massive sacrifices. One thing I can point out very quickly here, it's also today marks the beginning of World War One in 1914. In addition, it also marks the 81st anniversary of the Bonus Army camps being dispersed, which was the polite word back then of the Army coming in and crushing them.
By Douglas MacArthur.
Just to show that we haven't treated our veterans very well, and we kind of have a history of that.
Amicia Cross, your thoughts on Korean veterans and their contribution to the world today?
I think that we as Americans in a lot of ways should be ashamed of just our ill recognition of those who served in the Korean War. As being the youngest person on this panel, I know going back through my political science education as well as my history education, the Korean War wasn't something of major focus. It was something that was just a pinpoint as a part of a much larger conversation. And maybe we talked about it for 20 minutes and then just kept going. And I think that that's pretty much what younger Americans are getting when it comes to the Korean War. It's not something that we focus on. I think that's really sad.
And even when I was in school many years ago, Amicia, it was the same thing. You know, Vietnam was happening, so that wasn't in the books. We barely talked about Korea. I'm the daughter of a World War II veteran, so I know how much his service meant to me and also how much the GI Bill meant to him and to our family. So I work with a group called Leave No Veteran Behind today because I don't think any of us should. Whether we served or not, we owe it to all the people who did serve, whether in Iraq, Afghanistan, Korea. We owe all those men and women a real debt of gratitude and honor.
I want to say something about the GI Bill because that is one of the greatest government programs that the U.S. has ever put through. It had some defects. It was allowed to be handled at the state level, which meant that there was discrimination in the South against African Americans. So I don't want to completely look over those things. But the fact is the GI Bill allowed a lot of people to go to college for the first time. The Korean War has been overlooked. It could have been much, much worse. There was a strong proposal by Douglas MacArthur to use nuclear weapons against China. So this could have been much worse. I think you're right about what President Obama said about it, but I think he made a terrible misstep in his statements about Vietnam in talking about Ho Chi Minh as somehow drawing on America's founding fathers.
Let's get to that in a second.
Let's
get to that in just a second. I want to say something about Korea as well, and it echoes what has been said. I had the privilege of visiting Seoul last fall, and you get off the plane in Seoul at probably the greatest airport today in the world, Incheon Airport, and you are treated to an extraordinary example of what free people can do when they're given the opportunity to do it. And Seoul, Korea, and I had the further privilege of getting out beyond Seoul into the countryside a little bit. And it's hard to get to the countryside because you have to go through factory after factory after factory after factory after factory. These people are working like you cannot believe. And I felt I was choked up because, you know, you're an American. I had nothing to do with the Korean War whatsoever. I came along after it was ended. But, you know, you land in a distant country and you know that our countrymen and women died to make it free. And I wonder if this gets lost in a lot of our blame America first narrative.
This is so true. And they actually had a GDP per capita that was lower than North Korea, I believe as late as 1960. And now they're like a foot higher in terms of their height. I mean, but I want to say something that's a larger...
You mean literally, right?
Literally.
Because the health of the people,
I mean,
and the malnutrition in the North.
So America... But America not only fought for their freedom, it did one more thing. It's integrated them into a world economy, and it's provided stability because there was tremendous tension and even hatred between Japan and Korea. The United States stabilized all that, and there was one of those quiet markers that was passed over in the past year that people haven't noticed, but I want to raise. This year, for the first time, more than half the world's GDP comes from developing countries. It's coming from Korea, Taiwan, China, of course,
India.
Brazil, Mexico. This is truly stunning. And this is happening because these countries have moved to freer markets, not always free, but freer markets in a world economy that's been fairly liberal.
Well, let's take up then this statement by the, since we all sort of support the president and what he said about Korea, this thing about Ho Chi Minh, which I think kind of goes back to when he was a student and he was working as a busboy at the Parker House Hotel in Boston. And he was very, you know, Ho Chi Minh was actually, you know, sort of a young person who got to know a lot about America and did a lot of reading. And his work as a waiter or a busboy was on the Freedom Trail, you know, and this then got recycled during the 60s by the left as a connection between the forefathers of America, the founders of America, and Ho Chi Minh's determination for a so-called independent Vietnam. Where did we go wrong on that?
I got nothing, Chris. I didn't hear it. I got nothing. Absolutely. Sorry.
Scott?
I'm with Kitty. Can you tell us the quote? Do you have it in front of you?
I didn't hear it.
Or Charles, you know it.
What happened was that in a meeting with a representative of Vietnam, in trying to reach out and sort of be warm and welcoming, the president of the United States, in effect, said, gee, we come from kind of similar backgrounds and so forth, and Ho did this. I think it was just a terrible misstatement about where Ho Chi Minh was coming from.
Indicates lack of preparation, but not here at Beyond the Beltway. We'll be back in a few minutes. Good evening. It's Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont on Beyond the Beltway. We've got a very chatty panel tonight, which is good for us. Amisha Cross, Scott Stantis, Kitty Kurth, Charles Lipson. Let's get to the business of foreign policy. Let's get to developments overseas this week. We have to note with great sadness, violence has continued in downtown Cairo. More than 80, at least. That was as of about a few hours ago. The death toll may well be higher for weekend violence in downtown Cairo. We're seeing the army make a decision and execute a decision to oust the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Muslim Brotherhood in downtown Cairo is saying, we're not going to go, and we want to have our president back and reinstated. It appears that that is not going to happen. Kitty, what's the next step for U.S. foreign policy for addressing what has been an American ally since the early 1980s and the late 70s in the days of Anwar Sadat and Camp David.
Can I tell a little story about how much they're our ally? When I was there with Gore, we were driving in the motorcade and none of us could talk to each other on our radios because the Egyptians were jamming our radio signals with equipment that we had bought for them. and every decision about the visit, including the backdrop of where we were going to have the press conference, they had to call back to President Mubarak himself for it. So that was the kind of total control that's been exercised on Egyptian society for these many years. Charles, I can't remember what year Mubarak took office, but I know you know. But it's going to take them a while to figure out democracy. They've had elections for a long time, but they've never had democracy. And I feel horrible about the people that are being killed because of it, but I'm not necessarily surprised by it. I didn't think that the first round of elections was going to take. I didn't think it would result in this violence.
Charles, how long until a functioning democracy, and what do we do until then?
I think it's beyond the horizon. I think that we have a real problem throughout the Middle East. If you start with Turkey, which has moved in a kind of slow but steady direction toward Islamicism. They pulled back maybe a little bit recently, or at least stopped moving forward. We have a big problem in Syria. We have what looks like an emerging possible civil war in Egypt.
And I want to get back to Syria in a moment, but go right ahead as you contextualize.
And we could go on over to Libya, which is total chaos now. We can't even get in to investigate the people who were there. We have people who killed our representatives, people who went to work for us, and those people are sitting in coffee houses, and we can't even go in and get them because it's too dangerous, at least so the administration says. In Egypt, the problem is very simple. We've had a simple but not at all easily resolved. We have had a very simplistic notion of what a democracy is. If you have one vote, and somebody's elected, well, then what happens if the people who are elected systematically shut down all the other opposition, free speech, religious freedom, start killing all the Christians in the country?
Yeah.
If you're the wrong kind of Muslim, you're subject to all kinds of problems. Start backing terrorist groups in related countries. That's exactly what's happened there. And what caused this movement now was that they were systematically trying to take over the military. Once that had happened, there would have been no way to fight back
against
them.
That's when the military
drew
the
line. Can I just
say
that I agree with Charles again tonight? I'd like to mark this down on the scorecard.
Go right ahead. Scott, go ahead.
I think, let's reel it back to how the White House, how America should be responding to this
right now.
And the big question right now is, was this a coup or is this a revolution? We were privileged this week at our editorial board meeting at the Chicago Tribune to have a group of Arab students. Four of them were from Egypt, and it was remarkable how passionate they were that it was a coup, it's a revolution. Now, which one is it? Right now, the White House is not using the C word because then they were cut off aid to Egypt, and they don't want to do that. We may get a regime in there that's actually a little friendlier to us, un peu, if I could use my French. So as America, going forward, what do we do? Do we just take a half a step back and watch what happens there, look at it as a civil war and say, let this fall out, or do we get engaged?
Misha, do you have the answer?
For
Scott's question?
Comment on Egypt.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, when we're looking at democracy, it's hard to compare democracy in the Middle East to something that's us. The United States has its own particular democracy. I would argue that the Egyptian one is somewhat of a totalitarian, which is an identification for a democracy. But we're comparing it to a democracy that's free and open, and theirs technically was never meant to be, nor was it ever created that way. So as demonstrative and hateful as it happens to be to watch what's going on there right now, it's also something in which you'll see in a lot of areas where they do not have the same participatory democracy surrounding them. And their examples are not the same as what we have.
Well, they have Israel right next door, by the way. So they can just look across the border and say there's a democracy that works, has religious freedom, good economy, open economy.
Well, I want to ask, and I'll report to the listeners who are listening. A show of hands: how many of us have faith that the John Kerry State Department and Barack Obama's White House are on top of this and have a plan to assist those elements of Egyptian society that are true-hearted in a desire for some sort of constitutional governmental arrangement, if not, as Amisha points out, our kind of democracy? Do we think that the United States is positively affecting events over there, or are we in a position now where we really need to be a bystander? So show of hands, how many have faith? One show of hands. Okay.
Without us particularly positing someone for that position, which we have done and played in several roles when it comes to democracy in the Middle East, how is that even possible?
I think Kerry is kind of stepping out in front on it himself.
Okay. Do you think he knows what he's doing?
Yeah.
What is he doing?
I don't think he can tell us yet, because I think that, no, I think, Chris, as Charles so eloquently pointed out, you know, there's...
Keep talking, Kitty. Just say as much as you need to say. I cede my time to you.
You're yielding back the
there, you know, people elected... They had a democratic election, and people had different expectations of what they thought that was going to be than what it turned out to be. Unfortunately, all across Africa, we have examples of democratically held elections where the leaders have quickly turned into dictators. And we've seen it again and again and again. And unfortunately, they're not looking to Israel. They seem to have been looking to a lot of other places in Africa, sadly.
Let me put this in a little bit of context. I think that what President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry are trying to execute a pivot to Asia. They think that's where the focus of our policy should be. They're drawn into the Middle East because of their problems there. But we have relatively few resources. I think that the modesty that's being expressed around the table about how much we can affect events is something that they're very much seized of. I think what this means in practice is that we will end up quietly and then eventually more strongly supporting the military there, simply because I think that the opposition, which is a strong hardline Islamicist, proved that once they were in office, instead of moderating,
right,
they actually became stronger.
They were militant. So I want to ask, are we looking, it sounds like we are looking at a revised Mubarak sort of situation in which a leader will emerge out of the establishment. That leader is going to probably, to placate folks like the United States and the European Union, is going to try and foster appropriate social structures or civil society.
Including elections. Well, there'll be elections.
There will be elections, and there will be a few newspapers, and the Muslim Brotherhood will get to have a magazine or a website. I mean, we've had years under Mubarak in the last 10 years when the number of books published in Egypt was less than the new list of titles published by the University of Chicago Press. So
where democracy is really flourishing.
Good to know.
But, and that's, you know, our next
Park,
segment.
All over Hyde Park, people are voting.
Segment.
They only vote for one person, but they vote.
I think what's fascinating at the University of Chicago is how that I think he was a political science graduate student who studied the voting behavior of the mummies at the Oriental Institute. And it was funny because they were all voting in Democratic primaries.
That's shocking to me.
Shocking.
But the coup versus revolution question is huge because it's money. And the money is huge. And quite honestly, you know, Israel, we're going to be listening a lot to what Israel wants to happen in Egypt.
And they've been very clear. They want the money to continue.
Right.
They do not want
So they don't want us to call it a coup.
Scott, is that going
to... If we call it a coup, we have to cut off the money.
I think the administration is pretty much down the, this was not a coup.
Exactly. However, when the army marches in and extracts a duly elected official, that's a coup.
It looked like a coup to me.
It
was
smelled
watching
like a coup.
It
quacked
Sweden.
Like a coup.
I was watching it
How
with
did
a group
Sweden
of people
report
in Sweden
on it? Yeah.
Well, we were watching on European CNN, and everybody that I was sitting in the room with, and this was in the middle of Politicians Week in Sweden, so I was with a lot of political people, and everybody was saying, well, it looks like a coup to us, and none of us, including me, understood it until I heard the rationale that if it's a coup, we have to cut off aid.
And that's by law.
And I know how important our aid to Egypt is in to stabilizing the rest of the Middle East.
That tells you how unintended consequences can creep into laws generally. And the more complex the laws, the more likely there are to be unintended consequences.
Well, that sounds like a Chicago Tribune editorial on the part-timing of America, the unintended consequences of Obamacare. And Scott didn't ask me to point that out. We might get back to domestic, but first we've got to talk about Syria. That'll be after the break. I'm Chris Roebling, sitting in for Bruce Dumont. You are tuned in to Beyond the Beltway. We appreciate your listening, and we hope you'll stick with us over the next few minutes. Sunday evening, Beyond the Beltway. Instead of Bruce Dumont, my name is Chris Roebling, sitting in for Bruce this evening, joined by Scott Stantis of the Chicago Tribune, Charles Lipson of the University of Chicago, Misha Cross, an activist here in Chicago, and Kitty Kurth, longtime Democratic campaign consultant. We're doing a little bit of foreign policy here tonight, and that last segment about Egypt leads to a conversation about Syria, where I think we have to be concerned for all manner of reason, not the least of which is its neighbor Israel, and the sort of descent into chaos and civil war, out and out, just absolute civil war, which now seems to be coming on the heels of an American initiative to take a position in some support of the insurgents over in Syria who are challenging Bashar Assad and his regime. Now, this is very, Scott mentioned earlier, the anniversary of the start of the First World War. And of course, Syria, as we know it, emanates from the Treaty of Versailles, which itself is topic for many hours of conversation. But just dealing with these dynamics, are we setting ourselves up? Should the world be preparing to see a new nest of terrorism in that which we used to call Syria?
Can I make one tiny point on this?
One
on
tiny
Egypt
point.
Before we move
oh,
on.
Oh, on Egypt. You want to talk
While to many people in many countries outside of Egypt, it looked like a coup, we have former interns and other young friends in Egypt who were out in Tahrir Square. And they feel like it was a revolution. They feel like what they wanted to have happen happened and that they were creating change. So,
and that
you know,
the army was executing the change that they needed.
Yes.
Right.
So, you know, sometimes what
there are
you
many
say,
different views
sometimes
of it.
What you say is based on where you're sitting.
Sure, sure.
So, you know, and Scott said, you know, in his young group of Arab kids, some thought it was a coup, some thought it was a revolution, right?
Right. These are Egyptian
kids. Yeah. So even amongst Egyptian kids, I think it's different. In Syria, I have no answers, Chris, but what I think we need to think about and look hard about is not only the people who are within Syria, but the refugees who are going into every other country and creating need and pockets of need in every other country. It's a regional issue. It's not a Syrian issue.
Well, Scott was going to say something, and then I want to ask, we've got to get, Kitty's mentioning regional issue. I also want to talk about Russia.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So in terms of Syria, again, the kids who were there, we had some Syrian kids, and they asked, should we go in? And they said, we wish you'd gone in sooner. Because usually on these kinds of revolutions, at the beginning, especially of the Arab Spring, you had the intellectuals, the students, the people who wanted an open and free society. As this progressed and Assad was able to weed these people out, what's left is radical Islamists. And do we really want to arm them? I don't think we do.
Yeah, I want to explain in a very brief way what I think has gone on there, because I'm in complete agreement with what's been said so far. There was a popular movement to oust the Assad family, which represents a very small minority kind of sect within Shia called the Alawites. They had support from Iran, from Hezbollah, and as things got tougher, they got a lot more support from Iran. They got a lot more support from Hezbollah, which is acting as Iran's proxy, and they got support from Russia.
And let's just point out, some of that was transited through Iraq.
Absolutely. In fact, it went straight through Iraq, and we can get into that. But the fact is, Iraq has been acting in a pro-Iran fashion in that area. As the fighting got tougher, what happened was that the sort of if there were centrist groups or moderate groups or democratic-oriented groups, they were dwarfed by the al-Qaeda, Sunni-oriented Salafists who came in to fight. They're now coming from all over the world to fight. As that has happened, local people who are just ordinary people on the ground have tried to flee the country. That's destabilizing both Jordan and, to some extent, Turkey. But it creates problems all over the region. And the point, I think, is for U.S. policy intervention. Now, 100,000 people or so have probably died in the fighting, and there's no end in sight. It should also be said that if Assad wins, he won't be the old Assad. He'll be very much a puppet of the Iranians and the Russians who propped him up. However, if the other side wins, we will have set up a Taliban-type regime in Syria on the Mediterranean, right next to Turkey, right next to Jordan, right next to Israel. It's not just Israel. It's all these other allies.
And it's, so this is it's a very, Egypt as well.
And
the
we
Syrians
do not
are going
have any good
well.
Options. We waited too long.
Amisha?
I was going to 100% agree. I do think that we waited too long. And when you look at a situation like what's going on in Syria right now, you can't just look at Assad. You have to look at all of the subnational actors that are surrounding him and supporting him. And those subnational actors have groups that are throughout the Middle East, and they have been trained, and they are coming in to his rescue in a lot of instances, and they are not allowing him to be completely isolated, which was originally part of the United States plan. Isolate Assad, get rid of the family, then we start a new regime. That's not necessarily what's happening. He's going to fight to the death.
Kitty already said, you know, where you stand sometimes depends on where you sit. So now let's rotate over. If you are Benjamin Netanyahu and you are responsible for the security and the safety of the state of Israel and the independence of the state of Israel, and you are seeing this going on, and you understand far better, I would say, even than our distinguished friend Charles and all of his learning. I mean, if you're getting all of those intelligence reports, how do you then translate that current situation into your evaluation of what to do about Iran?
Well, let me just first say what Israel has been trying to do about Syria. When this first started, I spoke with Israel's ambassador to the United States and asked in a flat way, in a public forum, do you want Assad out? And his answer was yes. I don't know that they would say that anymore. I don't know that they're making those statements. What they're actually doing there is they're really the most concerned about transshipment of Iranian weapons to Hezbollah, and they're also very concerned about the possible overthrow of the Jordanian regime. I think that the crisis in Iran is coming within the next year. I think it's just inconceivable that the United States will do anything, and I don't know whether, in the absence of U.S. action, the Israelis will want to.
Well, and if Jordan falls, now we're talking about the Saudi kingdom. I mean, if Jordan is imperiled by these events, you're in a very different situation. You have a very different neighborhood than what we had even 6 years ago. Kitty, do you think that Samantha Power and National Security Advisor Susan Rice and John Kerry are equal to this task? And if so, what do you think is the policy of the administration that gives you hope that this will be resolved, not just well for Israel, but well for, you know, the innocent civilians, many of whom have now died, 100,000 have died up in Syria?
I don't know what their policy is yet. I'm looking forward to seeing it. I know that some of our policies in the region have been very misguided going back years. I had a group of Iraqi businessmen in my office here in Chicago, and they told me something that scared me more than anything I've heard about in the region. In the region, in the parts of Iraq that we controlled, there was no working electricity, and people were really pissed off. In the parts of Iraq next to Iran, Iran was coming in and putting in electrification and giving people electricity and water, the basic stuff of life. That, to me, was a really good foreign policy. I hate to say it because it was coming from Iran, but, you know, if we're going in and destroying countries and not building countries, the people are not going to like us. The people are not going to be with us. So I think that whatever policies we do in these regions, we have to think about the people, not just the armies.
Scott Stantis, do you see any policy out of the White House and the administration that gives you hope?
Not right now. I think it's because it is so violent, because it is so explosive in a literal and figurative way. Susan Rice participated, from what we've been hearing from the press, from the New York Times, in talking to Morsi and saying, you're out. You got a half hour to back your bags. We back this coup. That may not have been the wisest decision they could have made. Where the Muslim Brotherhood was going was problematic. They had not instituted this, but you also talked about going into the armed forces. What do we? I guess the real question is, we can look back and say, you know, the Syrian policy was late, the Egyptian policy may be late, or we were involved when we shouldn't have been in places where we were. But now I think we have to face the question, what happens going forward? And I think in Egypt, you take a half a step back. I think the White House, although this is, you know, tricky legal tap dancing, you don't call it a coup. You continue financial support for what's there now, and you wait and see.
I think that that's exactly the policy that they're playing. I've heard among fairly serious foreign policy people, I have not heard a lot of criticism of the Obama administration's policy in Egypt. I have heard criticism about Syria and intense criticism about the misplay of the end game in Iraq, which was sort of there to be handled in a better way. But I think that the big problem to some extent, events are in the saddle. They don't have any easy answers to any of these. But the other thing is that they had a big strategy when they came in. A friendly, outreached hand toward our traditional adversaries would really change things. And I think what they found is that that didn't work.
We are in the midst of a foreign policy conversation, but our phone number, I want to repeat for your benefit, is 800-723-8289, 800-723-8289. It's Beyond the Beltway. Let's get back to domestic politics for our last segment coming up after these words, and we'll hear from you. This is Beyond the Beltway Sunday night. Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont. Sunday evening, Beyond the Beltway. My name is Chris Roebling, sitting in for Bruce Dumont, and joining us this evening, Charles Lipson, Amicia Cross, Scott Stantis, and Kitty Kurth. Our phone number, 1-800-723-8289. Let's get some phone calls in here. If you've got anything you want to say, you want a reaction from our illustrious panel, give us a call, 1-800-723-8289. Just in this last segment, let's get back for a second to Obamacare. It's such a big issue. The administration has said it is not going to impose the employer mandate. It has left the individual mandate. But people are still asking, where is the legal authority for the administration to pick and choose parts of this big bill that it wanted so badly? And if it wanted it so badly, why is it picking and choosing elements to enforce in, say, January of 2014?
Well, to me, it's from what I read, and I haven't read exhaustively on it, but it sounded like it was quite literally just an implementation problem, that states were saying back to them, we're not ready to take in all these clients yet from the employer-based, and the employers were also saying, we're not ready to do it yet. And I think there was a lot of pressure from the Chamber of Commerce and from the states at the same time, both coming down on the administration saying, wait.
And again, I said this in an earlier segment. I'll say it again. 2014, midterm elections, that's what this comes down to. If you had instituted this, it would have caused some havoc. unemployment probably, or at least full-time employment, would have gone up, ticked up during an election cycle. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to be cynical about politics.
So Kitty says it's being withheld because of technical implementation problems. Scott sees the dark light of political considerations. Keith from Baltimore, Maryland, now joins us. Keith, what is your bottom line point for the panel? Keith from Baltimore, Maryland, joining us now. You're on the air. Yes, go ahead.
I wanted to say one of the things that you never hear, but the IRS is a great example of it, is Obamacare politicizes one-sixth of the economy. So in other words, like the IRS, you would think it would never be possible that the politicians could get involved where somebody's taxes would be higher. Well, the same thing will happen with health care. If you're a Republican and you need a liver, well, you're
going
to have to wait.
So Keith from Baltimore, thank you for your call. He sees the possibility of politics entering into the administration of health care. Mike, Delray Beach, Florida, listening on Sirius XM. Mike, your view.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on. You know, I really just wanted to pose a question to your panel. I think it would be appropriate for me to defer to them, seeing that they are the experts. Though I'm a supporter of the idea of healthcare, because healthcare is obviously, you know, it's been a big issue in the country, and the cost has been going up for years, way before implementation.
Sure.
Increased significantly. Do they think that there is enough in the bill as far as cost controls, and are the American people willing to do enough to implement cost controls?
All right.
In the country in order to...
Mike, thank you very much for that question. Two quick yes or no answers. Is there enough cost control, and are the American people going to do enough? Quick question. Quick
yes, answer. And Mike, I'll talk to you about it the next time I'm down in Delray Beach, which is frequently. But
gotta go
yes,
quick,
because of all the cost savings, because people will stop using emergency rooms as their primary care physician.
Alicia, is there enough on cost control?
No. I don't think so, because if you look at the pushback that's coming from a lot of the southern states specifically, and looking at the number of people who are uninsured there, it's going to be really hard for you to actually say that there's any level of benefit or cost control for those regions.
Cost control, Scott?
There are not. If to achieve what they want to achieve, I would say no.
Charles Lipson?
No, and the problem is they're going to run into a budget hole, and when they run into a budget hole, then the political problems are really going to start.
We could ask our ambassador from the youth, Amisha, if all of her healthy young friends are going to sign up to take care of old guys like you and me. But we'll go to Joanne in Schaumburg first. Joanne, you're on the air. Oh.
And you suggested I get a hold of Romney's camp. But in any event, I have to disagree with your comments earlier about Obamacare, where you think it would be a mistake to try to defund it.
Very quickly, very quickly. All right. Thank you. Joanne says healthcare is a train wreck.
As someone who hasn't been able to afford health insurance since my premiums went up from $250 to $2,500
right.
for no change in health, just change in healthcare costs, I'm really, really looking forward to being able to buy health insurance.
But I want to say Joanne's true-hearted. And she believes that if we don't stop the funding now, I know this because I know this line of thinking. If you don't stop the funding now, once it gets started, this is what Ted Cruz said, it's almost like a narcotic. People will get
That's
addicted.
Right.
That could very well be true. The problem is if the Republicans stop the government, they'll never be in a position ever to do anything to really modify it.
In
later.
20 years, all these same people are going to be holding up signs saying, get your government hands off my Obamacare, because everybody's going to love it as much as they love Medicare and as much as they love Social Security.
Scott.
We'll get back here in 20 years and talk about it. And Amisha will be here anyway.
Time to defund. Is it defund Obamacare, whatever the cost, or do you play the longer game like Charles saying?
I think what Charles said is absolutely correct in a purely political sense. You cannot shut down the government. You look like an idiot. You've done it before. Again, purely political standpoint, it's a loser. You're going to – and do you want the Republican Party to become more marginalized, a minority party? If you really feel strongly about these battles, you won't be able to fight them in the future.
But that doesn't mean we don't appreciate Joanne's listenership in Schaumburg or her true-hearted participation in the conversation.
Absolutely.
All right, Joanne, thank you for calling in. And thank you, everyone, for listening, whether it was on radio or on the web. Charles Lipson of the University of Chicago, thank you so much. Amisha Cross, Scott Stantis, Kitty Kurth. What a terrific panel. It's Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont, keeping the chair warm. He's going to be back next week. And if you're living in Chicago, you can watch him on TV at 10:30. Good night.